Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me, as per usual, is James.
Hello.
Before we get started, check out our website, themacguffinmen.com. We've got a lot of good, interesting content. Last week, we talked about Gone Girl, and we've talked about recently Varsity Blues. Earlier this summer, we talked about Apocalypse Now, and a lot of things in between. We talked about Carrie. All these good things. Follow us on Twitter at the MacGuffin Men. It's a big fall in cinema, so we're gonna have a lot of interesting topics, interesting modern topics to talk about. We're finally in a place in the calendar where we can talk about new movies and not just be depressed like we were with the Expendables. But yeah, we're still talking about old movies today, so we'll just get right to that, I suppose.
What did you see, Clarice? What did you see?
Lamb. They were screaming.
They were slaughtering the spring lambs.
They were screaming.
And you ran away?
No. First I tried to free them. I opened the gate to their pen, but they wouldn't run. They just stood there, confused. They wouldn't run.
But you could, and you did, didn't you?
Yes. I took one lamb and I ran away as fast as I could.
Where were you going, Clarice?
I don't know. I didn't have any food, any water, and it was very cold. Very cold.
All right, James.
Yes.
Oh, broke the silence.
What movie do you suppose we're talking about today?
Silence of the Lambs, I suppose. I don't know. I didn't need to sleuth. We had a conversation about this. Yeah.
Yep, you're right.
This topic was recommended to us by John Alistair via Twitter. So
Who?
thank you, John Alistair.
Okay.
Yeah.
Rings a bell. Yeah, he's been requesting this one for a while.
I mean, he sent us a bunch of requests earlier this summer, and this one we're following through on.
Yes, it's a movie that I think is near and dear to his heart, and I told him we were doing it, and he sent me some notes, some mm-hmm. things we're going to talk about.
So you really crowdsourced this one.
No, basically, if we ever mention an upcoming movie or topic or something, and you have something you want us to talk about or some point, feel free to contact us in one of the many ways to contact us.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we're all friends. If you're listening to this podcast, you have one of our phone numbers.
Exactly. But yeah, we were talking about Silence of the Lambs today.
Yes.
Jonathan Demme?
Demme, I believe.
Demme?
Is the pronunciation.
Yeah, that's true. Based on a Thomas Harris novel adapted for the screen by
I
Ted
believe it's
Talley.
Pronounced Tamash.
That's okay. I'm not giving you that one.
Because that one's not true.
Yeah, and it came out in 1992 and
91.
91?
Yep.
That's what I had, and I changed it. Anyway. Yes, in a very successful film.
Yeah, financially and critically, of course.
Yeah, won Best Picture, Best Actor, Best Actress, Best Director, Best Adapted Screenplay.
That is all correct.
That's a pretty nice lineup, though.
At the Oscars.
Yes.
Just as clarification.
Yeah, and again, kind of just one of those movies, we've talked about a few of them lately, that are just very culturally important and things that you just kind of see pop up in spoofs and pop culture in general pretty regularly.
Certainly in the 90s. I mean, it had a resurgence with all the sequels of the early 2000s. And by all the, I mean two. But yeah, it's not like Silence of the Lambs is something that's frequently referred to now. You know, it was very culturally important for sure. But I mean, what was the last time you heard somebody make a joke about fava beans?
Yeah, no, that's true. Very iconic, though. A couple iconic performances, a couple iconic moments, and lines of dialogue as well.
Yes, definitely. I'm not disputing that at all.
No. How do you feel about this movie? Do you like this movie? This is a movie that's kind of been on our radar for a long time, so we never really got too deep into. I don't really know your history with it, though.
Well, I saw it once, like, I don't know, back when I was still dumb. I wasn't crazy about it. Like, thought it was fine. Then watched it again this week. I think it's fucking amazing. Like, this movie is unbelievable.
Oh, I'm so glad you like it that much.
I am a huge fan. Like, I don't I feel like I have to sort of have more time with it before I make any proclamations to see if it sticks with me as much as it has over the last couple of days. But yeah, like, I mean, short of calling it a masterpiece, it's unbelievable. I think it's so fucking good.
Oh, I'm so glad you like it. Okay, so what do you like about it?
Well, it uses a Tom Petty song, and I've decided that is the only criteria I care about. So,
and a Q Lazarus song puts it over the top.
Exactly.
For you.
So 10 stars out of 5, and 5 Oscars out of 5.
5 half-eaten faces out of 4.
No, okay. So here's what's awesome about this movie, besides pretty much most things in this movie. it is, one, it's a very entertaining movie. It's just really enjoyable, and there's the kind of mystery aspects to it. Not so much of like who the killer is, but how they're going to get to the killer.
Right. For a while, you don't know, but... They let you in on that one pretty quickly, and then it's just the hunt that becomes interesting.
And it never really seems like it's going to be a thing where it's like, oh my god, it's been Scott Glenn this whole time, you know? Like, you never think for a second that it's that type of movie. And, you know, so it's very procedural, which is something that I enjoy. And I think Clarice is an extremely interesting character. I think the filmmaking is... just bananas. I don't know, man, we could go through this whole movie and break it down pretty much shot for shot, and I suspect there we could come up with like a really good meaning in at least 90% of these shots, like something that was thought out and specifically to mean something, and it's perfect, you know, like it's great. And then, like, I mean, like, this movie's so good that Anthony Hopkins is the third most interesting thing about it to me, you know?
Yeah.
And he's great in this movie. He's that type of character that's very easy to be entertained by. And, just a really engaging serial killer movie, which is just a type of movie I enjoy. And it's made basically perfectly. So I love filmmaking, so, yeah.
And then Clarice, then Hannibal.
I think the filmmaking is tied so much to what I think of Clarice as well that it's I'm very close. But yeah,
okay. And so I always liked this movie, but then didn't really know how to watch a movie properly for a long time. And
you were sitting on the couch upside down throughout the whole night.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, now watching this now and kind of having a better idea about how to read cinema, I appreciate it so much more. And as you said about being able to take a lot of these scenes and a lot of these shots, it's just a very fully realized movie. Like all the like much of the relationship stuff that's interesting between Clarice and Hannibal. Like finds its place visually in this movie, and that's something that I didn't fully appreciate, but there is just so much going on, and it's just such a well put together, well thought out movie, and so many of the dynamics of people getting along or power relations and people is just fleshed out through the cinematography so well, and that's what I gained the most appreciation for watching it this time around.
Yeah, absolutely. It's fully thought out is a good way to describe this movie, you know?
Yeah.
There's no thought stone that's been left unturned.
Right.
So we talked about what we generally like about this movie, which is all things in this film. But what do you think this movie's about? Because, I mean, we've probably both seen The Bone Collector, but we're not really thinking about The Bone Collector. You know, it's a serial killer movie, right?
Yeah, well, if you want to talk about what the movie's about, we can...
Yeah, let's get real.
Well, you can start at the title.
Yeah, fair enough.
You know, it's something that's discussed in the movie and I think really speaks to the central elements of the plot. What's your take on the meaning of Silence of the Lambs? Well, I mean, they kind of spell it out for you.
Yeah, exactly. There's that great scene in about the middle of the movie where Clarice kind of discusses it with Hannibal, that there was one time when she was kid after her dad died, where she tried to I think lambs were being slaughtered. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And lots of lambs are screaming. And so Clarice breaks into a very young Clarice breaks into a barn and tries to free one, and does get one out. But even that one is eventually killed. And the idea is that everybody in this movie wants to silence the metaphorical lambs in some way. Buffalo Bill wants to make these women quiet. Clarice wants to make these women quiet in a totally different way. Like, she wants to save them. Bill wants to kill them. And they each want to sort of silence the things inside of them that are bothering them. Like, Clarice wants to be able to sort of take on this world by herself. She wants to be able to achieve something by herself, and that's how she views her career. And yeah, it's just all about silencing these things, whether they're inside your head or outside of them, you know?
And so you say Buffalo Bill just wants to kill the women, but that's not really the extent of his lambs, right?
No, I'm just sort of using that as a more like a sort of comparison point for what Clarice wants to save the women, right? And Bill wants to kill them to silence the things in his head, you know, so that he can make his lady suit, if you will.
Yes. And what's Hannibal's motivation?
Well, that Hannibal doesn't have a ton of motivation, I don't think. I think he's just sort of at least in how I see it, he would prefer to be free, you know, like that's something that he would like. And that seems to be the only thing he really physically acts on throughout the movie. But it's that and the fact that he knows who he is and is totally comfortable with it is why he, aside from, you know, being in cages for the vast majority of this movie, why he's the least active in the film, you know, like physically.
Right. And he, as you said, he's not physically working towards anything but escape. So what's his motivation with Clarice? What's his adamant attitude towards understanding her, someone he, you know, was a complete stranger until she walked into his horrible little medieval dungeon with plexiglass?
So Lecter is good at reading people. I mean, we're told that. And he's a quick judge of people. And I think he just sort of sees something new and interesting in Clarice. I don't know how long he's been in jail for. I'm sure they mention it, but I know it's 8 years. Okay. Yeah. And he just, I don't know, there's something new to his life. Like, he mentions that, memories are what he has in place of a view. And that's just how little he has to work with. He has what's in his own head. And other than that, there's nothing new. Whereas, Clarice sort of feels like somebody that is different from the everyday. She's not like Frankie Faison's character, you know, Barney, I think. It's just, there's just something about her that is new and interesting to him, which is something that doesn't happen very frequently to somebody like Hannibal.
Right. And with Clarice, I think we have to mention her father as part of this.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Because that's, you know, she tells the story about the lambs in the context of it was right after her father died, and that's why she and her mother had to go live with this rancher.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, her mother died before her father.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm. And that, so she lives with the rancher after her dad dies. And it seems to me this, for her at least, the silence of the lambs is kind of this twofold of avenging her father's death by tracking down people who kill other people,
mm-hmm.
and protecting these girls, or, you know,
just protecting people in general.
Exactly. Protecting people in general through her work at the FBI. At this moment of her life, when we get to follow the action of what she does, it's, you know, capturing Buffalo Bill and saving the girls he has in his creepy dungeon and anyone else he might get in the meantime.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Let's talk about Hannibal a little bit.
Okay.
It's going to keep coming up. How do you feel about his arrival into the movie?
Like, the first shot? It's awesome. Like, it's just the
and then how he does show up.
I'm sorry, what was the question?
Like the way he's built up and talked about, and then when you see him for the first time.
Yeah, they just sort of, I don't know, it's just standard psycho setup. You know, it's like you're gonna get this crazy person that's but also very intelligent person, and don't pass him anything because he knows how to use it against you. Don't tell him anything. Don't go too close to the glass. You know, just sort of they set him up as a character to fear, and then there's a nice reveal that you know is coming, and then it's just so weird that Hannibal's just standing directly, like looking right at where you are, and there's just a reveal of him just standing there, not blinking, just waiting for Clarice, like he can't wait for her to show up, you know?
Yeah, and I think there's something sweet about it at the same time, like knowing what you know about him. You know, he creeps you out when you look at him, but he's just this aged man, you know, well kept, standing at attention, very well lit, clean uniform and everything, you know, and just not brooding, crouched in the corner, like just standing up straight, very polite. Like he has so many contradictions to him. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, what makes him so compelling. Like he's very polite and sweet and well educated, but he's cold and ruthless and, you know, unspeakably evil at the same time.
Yeah, exactly.
And yeah, that's the thing about that reveal is you don't expect him to be looking right at the camera, and then that terrifies you for a second, and then very quickly, I mean, in my experience, you kind of take the step back and you're like, oh, he's just this kind of normal looking dude who's waiting politely to have a kind conversation with someone. And then you kind of have to reassess the situation again because you know who it is that you're really dealing with, or at least, you know, you've kind of been told. And I think there's a lot of role reversals and contradictions in this movie. And I say that, you know, not that this movie isn't consistent. It's that, you know, it has all this fun with expectations and gender roles and things like that.
Yeah.
And I think Hannibal Lecter is just this big bag of unpredictability and contradictions that I think is one of the things that makes him so fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it's helpful that camera shot that we talked about leading up to his reveal is, I mean, it's going down a literal murderer's row, I presume. yeah. And that, you know, you get sort of a nice variation of the type of people you expect to be murderers in these movies. You know, you get the guy that just says hello or whatever, the first guy, and then you get a guy just sitting quietly and growling, and then what's the third guy?
Miggs.
Yeah. Him hopping around and being a lunatic, and then you just get the one well-lit cell with the potentially one intelligent person of the bunch, and certainly the one with good posture.
Yeah. Yeah, no, exactly. And it's that, again, like that posture makes him seem like such a nice, respectable gentleman. And then we know all these other things about him. And, you know, even his name, Hannibal Lecter, it sounds kind of elegant and proper. And then, you know, Hannibal, I think of the military leader who killed thousands and thousands of people.
Yeah.
Lecter, I think, like the French word for it's like reader, but also kind of takes the meaning of intellectual as someone who reads and someone who's well educated. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's in this medieval dungeon, but he's got all these, you know, classy drawings of like European cityscapes and things like that. And just in that introduction, there's so many things coming at you and you've heard all these things, but he's pretty gentlemanly overall to Clarice until, you know, she kind of starts pushing the questionnaire and things like that. But that whole scene of their first meeting is fascinating to me. And one of the best examples of how well put together this movie is. Like, we could do, I think, a long podcast or article or shot analysis of just who's making eye lines, how close these shots are, who can't keep eye contact with the camera when a certain thing is said, and just the power relations in this movie. That's something that gets played out through cinematography throughout the movie. But in that scene in particular, it's so well done and it's so constant. And you can watch and enjoy this movie without ever considering any of those elements. But when you do start to consider those elements, you just see how much more there is to this movie.
Yeah, that's where it goes from a good crime movie to a borderline masterpiece, as I believe I called it earlier.
Yeah.
Did you watch that link I sent you? The Tony Zhu just put out a...
Yes.
Yeah, okay. He put this out last night, you know, and he did the... it's the guy that makes the Every Frame a Painting videos. You should all watch all of his videos because he's one of the best film critics working today. He's really good. He just put out a video about David Fincher in the lead up to Gone Girl, and he totally does a scene breakdown of that that scene that you're talking about. And power dynamics are very present all throughout this movie in various relationships, and perspective has always been something that is important. Found in Jonathan Demme movies, and certainly his narrative films, at least. All of the Clarice and Hannibal meetups are the most interesting for that, I find, because there are two most engaging characters. They're the characters that are set up to be the two most engaging characters as well, and so the film really focuses in on those. Going with one of their later conversations, we talked about the scene where the title is kind of explained by Clarice. I think that scene's really, like, God, so fucking good. Like, just a masterclass of filmmaking in that one scene where they're in Memphis, where Hannibal's in that sort of large cage in the middle of a gymnasium or something. I don't know where they are.
They in the story, it's a courtroom. In real life, it's like a war museum, I believe.
Okay.
But they say it's a courtroom or like a civil, some kind of legal building.
Okay.
With massive roofs and I don't know. Anyway, continue.
Yeah, it's one of those courtrooms that they shoot the judge in, you know? Like Robert Downey Jr. is there or was there a year ago shooting a shitty movie. So that scene is we see them both framed through bars, right? And we get all the setup of Clarice walking along, pacing back and forth, and then they sort of have this conversation where we start to get to Clarice's past. And we know about her father's been dead, and we find that out, I think, in the first conversation they have. And that's another interesting thing about this movie is the way it spreads out the information it gives us about Clarice. Even though she's sitting down and talking to a character and giving him this information, it's spread out over the course of the film, which allows us to, I don't know, spend an extra 40 minutes in the dark in between these conversations. But as this conversation starts to happen, we see Hannibal framed from outside the cage, outside the cage looking in, and the reverse for Clarice. As Hannibal starts to ask questions, starts to do what is technically was his job before he was in prison, the camera dollies in very slowly, and it becomes this extreme close-up of Hannibal. And what that does is it removes the bars. When he's doing this with Clarice, he's no longer trapped, you know? He's in the place he wants to be, and he's also lit. Now, we cut to Clarice, who's in a regular close-up, not extreme. The bars are still present, because she's feeling trapped by her past. And bars are all visual metaphor for being trapped for obvious reasons. And eventually, by the end of the story, actually, probably pretty quickly into the story, she ends up being framed in an extreme close-up, and the bars are gone. But even then, she is in such a dark frame. Her hair is dark, covers so much of her face just because it's long enough to. And she's telling the story, and behind her is darkness. And then we cut back to Hannibal, who's in the light, and it's just this very bright, bright frame cut to this very dark frame. And it's just, even though Hannibal is the darker character, Clarice is the one that's lost in the darkness. And that scene is incredible, and I think really further proves our point about how interesting the scenes between the two of them are shot.
Yeah, and it's easy to think about this movie as kind of plain visually, because it's just a lot of this is just dialogues. There's not big chase scenes or big landscapes or, you know, nature shots and things like that. but they just managed to do so much with close-ups or seeing late in the movie when people finally share a two-shot. Like, it's actually so meaningful because we've had so many of these close-ups, so many of these just kind of side views that the moment I'm thinking of in particular is when Jack Crawford and Clarice Starling are discussing the case. And she's doing well and he's still kind of cold to her, and it's in the car. We only really see the back of the back of his head until mm-hmm. she says something so impressive he turns around, and that's kind of like a big moment just to get him turned around. And on paper it is still a good moment, but just the way that it's shot and having him kind of do that big 180 to look back at the camera and getting this close-up of his face and him kind of traversing some of the geography of the car, which is not much, but it's so meaningful when you're so restricted with your shots like this and that you've been playing them so tight that when you have something, any kind of movement like that or something big in the dialogue scenes, it just has so much more gravitas to it.
Yeah, and do you remember what happens exactly immediately after that in the conversation? That was a rhetorical question. I'm just going to tell you. He's impressed, as you mentioned, and that's a really good moment. And then he explains to her, like, Clarice knows that she was kept in the dark about something about Lecter, about the true motives of Crawford sending her there. And he fesses up to that. He's like, yeah, I couldn't have told you because then it would have ruined everything. And immediately upon Clarice finding that, the car enters a dark tunnel. And the scene is just... And Clarice is suddenly, like, shrouded in darkness like the whole car is. But it's just... Oh, it's so, so great. Like, that there's this one moment with this great reveal that you mentioned, and then Clarice finds out this other new piece of information and then is immediately lost again.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's just so much of her just trying to figure out her way through this movie. Mm-hmm. And another thing with that I'm reminded by when we talk space and things like that is... Space does play a pretty big role. And, you know, it does in the ways we've been talking about, kind of, you know, cinematography and things like that, how, you know, a close-up can lead someone to control, or someone being the light means, you know, they have more information and things like that. But this movie is, like, constantly moving, except for when it's not. We have these still shots and these dialogue scenes that are... you know, pretty static, but she does a lot of moving. Like, especially right at the beginning, we get Clarice is just running that obstacle course and climbing mm-hmm. and running and jumping and doing, you know, just negotiating all this geographical space. Mm-hmm. And even before that, the first thing we see, even before the credit of this movie, is the location of where this is taking place.
Yeah.
Like, there's the significance placed on the geography. So, you know, we have her running around and then she gets the call to go talk to Jack, and then that's when things get really still again. And those dialogue scenes, the camera's so still. And it's a very, like, personal movie. I don't mean it contains a lot of Jonathan Demme's life or Ted Talley's life or anything, but it's so much about personal communication and, you know, who these people really are and what's truly motivating them. Yeah. And that's something, obviously, Hannibal... talks about his first chance that he gets to talk about Buffalo Bill is, you know, what are the motivations? What purposes does this serve? And even when that's kind of the break from the first clue is, you know, coveting what we see. And that clue doesn't really get understood till near the very end of the movie. But it's because Buffalo Bill knew this girl and could see this girl. And that's why he grew to, you know, need to have her in his twisted way.
Yeah.
And there's so much isolation in this movie. So many of these people, so many of these characters, I think, are very lonely and very misunderstood. Mm-hmm. And we have Clarice, like, trying to kind of break down those barriers and, you know, advancing through the FBI, but also kind of learning a bit about herself and a bit about, you know, Hannibal and Buffalo Bill as she tries to kind of figure out what everyone's doing. And even when the camera's standing still, we kind of have this idea of geography being very important. Like, we'll have cameras inside places that she's entering before she kind of gets in there, but we mm-hmm. only ever see it as she's coming in. Like,
yeah.
We get a camera inside Buffalo Bill's house. We get a camera inside, like, a car she's looking into. We get a camera inside that storage bin. So just this idea of this woman fighting her way through the FBI and kind of fighting against all the adversity of being a minority and having lowered expectations and things like that. We see in a very visual way, as translated through the cameras, her, like, breaking down walls or opening doors and occupying new space that until then no one like her had been into. And it's just one more way that this story kind of tells a lot of the narrative through the visuals. And that's something that, you know, you can watch and totally have slip by you. But then if you really pay a close eye to it, you can see thematically just all the cinematography playing up to the strengths of this movie.
Yeah, absolutely. And even just in that obstacle course right at the beginning, I mean, she's just, the idea of that scene is to show that Clarice is determined. She's not going to let these obstacles stand in her way.
Yeah.
And the only thing that's going to stop her is the opportunity to advance her career or do the thing that she really wants. Immediately after she meets Crawford, we find out that she really wants to be in his division specifically. So, yeah, I mean, she stops immediately when somebody's like, hey, somebody wants to see you. But then we find out maybe if it was another person, she would have continued on her obstacle course, you know. But Crawford matters, and that position in life to her matters. And yeah, it's really great. And it also adds a nice little element for the end when she's going through Buffalo Bill's obstacle course of sorts.
Yeah, exactly. Like, she's just always moving, and like exploring new space and, you know, finding new geographical areas for her to occupy and explore. And then something like that meeting with Jack will come up, or something like talking to Hannibal, or, you know, anything that she does that's really important related to this case. And at that point, she is so focused, and she knows, like, this is the next step. Like, I need to live right here. I need to occupy this space until I can kind of move past this level. Like, I need to stick on this and overcome it. And as you said, she's just very, very determined and very good at what she does.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And we get a lot of, like, her POV as well. Like, we kind of look at a lot of things through her eyes, and we're meant mm-hmm. to really engage with, like, really identify with Clarice, obviously.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's kind of the most interesting thing about this movie to me is, well, you've talked about how, yeah, there's so many close-ups in this movie, and we just talked about Gone Girl and David Fincher, and he tries to avoid cutting in whenever possible because he knows that audiences are smart, and they know when you cut to a close-up that this information matters. So he tries to do it as little as possible to sort of save the importance. Jonathan Demme does it all the time, you know, like it's sort of like his default setting. And yeah, and what this movie lacks in sort of gorgeous, well-set-up wide shots, it totally makes up for it having these really fascinating close-ups and this different use of close-ups, like we've been describing. And I think the most fascinating thing about this movie thematically is the way it looks at perspective. The film, I think, is about how a person sees themselves, how others see them, and what they want to be. And I think we get all of that in Clarice's story specifically, get a lot of it with Buffalo Bill. And again, the reason why Hannibal is kind of left out of this is because he knows the answer to all of these questions, and he doesn't care because he's totally comfortable with them, you know. And I think that's sort of what separates the movie from just, like, even more so than the just sort of the serial killer genre, is that the way people care about being looked at, and then the way this movie shows us people looking at things, is just so fascinating. Like, specifically Clarice, she sees herself as, like, this little girl who wants to be strong enough to take on the world by herself. You know, she's been through all these things in her past, and she's still fighting to keep through it. She keeps going through this obstacle course. She wants to get out of the dark loneliness of unknowing and protecting the lambs or these women or just people in general is how she does that. And we get so many different examples of Clarice standing up for herself in this movie. One of my favorites being in the funeral home when Crawford excuses himself with the sheriff to talk about these sex crimes away from Clarice because she's a woman. And then when she immediately after clears out that room so that they can do this sort of makeshift autopsy, she has to speak up and assert herself as a person that matters in this situation. And when she does that, we don't get her point of view, but we get a camera framing her from behind as the largest thing in the frame, as all of these much smaller police leave the room because she is now more important than them. And I think that that's really interesting. And there's this sort of alternating between showing Clarice as very small in the frame, particularly at the beginning, and very large in the frame in moments like that where she is in control. And I think it's this sort of this alternating between how Clarice sees herself and how she wants to be seen. And she's trying to find the medium in between that where she can actually exist in, you know?
Yeah, and I think there's a more relevant contrast where earlier in that scene, as you said, at the funeral home where all the state police are there, we get that shot, kind of a low angle shot, looking up at all the group of these state troopers, and she kind of, you know, feels uncomfortable and feels out of place. You know, it's just one of those many shots of a bunch of men wearing the same thing and then her wearing something different and obviously being female.
Yeah, and they're all judging her for having been not being able to be in that conversation that Crawford has just excused himself
exactly
from the room for.
And so then, you know, she feels small or made to think that she does. And then once she asserts herself, that's when we get that shot of her from behind being something big. Like when she's meek and passive, you know, she's just that thing to that, you know, everyone's staring at her. She can't even maintain eye contact with the camera, which is sounds weird, but it's so constant in this movie that when it doesn't happen, it's unusual. And then, you know, when she asserts herself, she's, you know, bigger and everyone has to listen to her. And even though it takes a few times, she's absolutely in the right. And she's working for the FBI and she doesn't need 20 more state police in there for no reason. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I really like that kind of juxtaposition because it happens so close to each other. And we can see the difference of her, what seems like is supposed to be her natural role of just quiet and passive, to her really doing what she's actually capable of, which is taking control of a scene and participating in this autopsy to the point where she's pretty much running it. Like she's there to impress Jack. Jack's obviously higher in authority and, you know, the cameraman's there doing his thing, but she's really running it and doing all of the talking. And as we learn in the conversation she has with Jack Crawford on the ride home, she's doing it well.
Yeah. Well, and just to go back to that scene, like how she feels around these cops, right? In between the two things we have talked about, she looks out of into the funeral that's going on and sort of remembers her dad's funeral because being made to feel small like that reminds her of the feelings of being a kid and being at her dad's funeral. And that's something that she desperately wants to get away from. And so that's part of the reason why when she explains to Crawford, like, oh no, it matters. That's what she means. She's like, it matters that people see me as important here because if I don't see myself as important, then I'd get turned back into 10-year-old Clarice at her dad's funeral. And that's something I don't want to go back to. And with that autopsy scene, yeah, you're exactly correct. And she doesn't seem to be in control until she asserts herself in that scene either, because we see her in a reflection and we see that Crawford sees her in a reflection, sort of mentally preparing herself to see this body. And then, you know, she does her more basic part of the job until she sees something that nobody else can see, which is that there's something in the corpse's throat. And then from that point on, she really sort of takes charge in the scene. She points out the fingernail thing about somebody has been doing some clawing. And that's sort of where we really get Clarice even more so coming into her own as a really good agent and a really strong adult. You know?
Yeah, and it's funny because we were talking
about... Fuck, this movie's so good.
Well, we were talking about her kind of protecting the innocent and those who get preyed on. And it's funny that as a woman, everywhere she goes, she seems to be, you know, prey for some other predator out there.
Yeah, and
you know?
She's objectified so many times in this movie. There's so many moments where she's either asked out on a date or clearly being checked out. There's a scene that even where they just show her getting on an airplane out of Memphis, or they show her at an airport getting out of Memphis, and that scene is meant to show us she's in an airport, but even then they throw in just some guy checking her out.
Yeah.
Like a character that means nothing otherwise. Anyway, sorry.
No, that's it. It's just I think gender is just such a big part of this movie. We can't avoid it.
Oh, absolutely.
The whole time. Her being a female, we've talked about it a bit, but it's so central to this movie. And this idea of her being the one to protect the innocent and her being the one that people are, you know, either checking out or asking out or trying to take advantage of, is interesting. And I just wanted your take on what this movie is saying about her gender and what that means for what her career is going to be. Because a really small one that happens really early is when Jack's talking to her about seeing Dr. Lecter for the first time and said, "I have a job and I thought of you." It's actually more of an interesting errand, which, you know, is just coded like housework and, you know, women's work, whatever. What she's doing is walking into death row with all these people who are going to verbally assault her and throw semen at her to talk to a serial killer slash cannibal. You know, it's not exactly ironing shirts. It's very hard work, but it's always framed, at least in this case, as something feminine. And there's just a couple of examples of her dealing with objects that are traditionally coded as very male or very female, and a couple different reactions to it. So just kind of in gender as a general subject, what do you think of Clarice as the female agent in this movie?
Gender is very important to this movie, for the reasons you explained, and I think it's just to add another element to her fight, you know, like to be seen as somebody that's an equal in a world where traditionally, particularly back when this, I don't know when this movie take place in, like 1988. I think that's when the book was published, right? But certainly around that time period, you know, the movie comes out in 1991.
Yeah, I think it's like 89, according to the newspaper that she sees at the start. Okay. So 89 to 90 something.
Yeah. So clearly, even more so than now, women would be the minority in positions like Clarice. And we can even just see it just in among the people that she's training with. We have Casey Lemons playing her partner. But other than that, pretty much everybody training seems to be a male. I don't know if we ever see another female FBI agent at all through the movie, do we?
I don't think so. As you said, there's the one in training that she's friends with, and then one woman helps her at the office, but she's more of a receptionist. Like, it could just be a civilian administrator kind of role. There is one other woman, but just so dominated by males.
Well, and there is that female police officer in Memphis who's very important to, or at least I suspect important to Clarice being able to see Hannibal in Memphis, where she kind of gives this glance to the captain with the weird mustache. It's like, yeah, she like to sort of stand up for Clarice a little bit, sort of. But yeah, gender is very important, and particularly knowing the time period where the movie came out, it's another obstacle for her to overcome. And given the time period, it's an even bigger obstacle than one might suspect now in 2014.
Yeah, yeah, and so.
And it's just, again, it's about perspective, about how men see women, you know, and Clarice wants that perspective to change, basically.
Right. And so we get that her dealing with Chilton very early on, the first time she goes to see. He was a fantastic douchebag, like fantastic. So he makes a move on her because he's a male in this movie. Yeah. And she shuts
it down. He just actively wanted to promote tourism in Baltimore.
Such a fun town, if I learned anything from The Wire. So she shuts him down, and then he says, you know, okay, let's go in here, we'll do the interview together. And then she makes it clear he wants to do it on her own. He takes offense to this. And then she kind of reneges a little bit and flirts a little and says, you know, oh, it's I wanted the, you know, your company, essentially, you know, just kind of some some vague non-committal flirting.
Yeah, I don't know that that was necessarily meant to be complimentary.
No, I think, that's like underhanded.
That could go either way. Yeah, sorry. I didn't
continue. Well, no, but it's like the use of her sexuality in this case gets her nothing.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, Chilton's still offended and walks away, and, you know, she seems to get what she would have got even if she didn't try that last-ditch attempt of batting her eyelashes or whatever. Yeah.
And just another quick thing with that scene in Chilton's office. Chilton shot all in close-ups at the beginning until he basically gets shut down by Clarice, where we finally see him in a wide shot, and he is a very small percentage of the frame as opposed to 90% of the frame, which he had been before. And I thought that was very funny.
Yeah, and all the other flirting stuff in this movie is usually indirect with the eye line, and hers isn't. Like, you, even through the cinematography, you can tell that this is very, very half to quarter hearted flirting. Like,
yeah,
she just doesn't want to piss off a contact, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
But the point is, like, it doesn't work. She walks, like, he walks away spurned, and her flirting never works. She never really uses her femininity or gender or looks or anything to get anything in this movie.
No, absolutely. Right?
Like, she gets hit on a lot, but it seems like she still gets what she would have got from all those people. Like, the guys and the bug dudes, whatever we call them, etymologists. They flirt. She says no. Basically, it's what would have happened if she were a dude. Like, they just get down to the business, and then that's that, right?
Yeah.
But then we have some other examples of her, and as I was saying, like, traditionally male-coded things. She uses the car jack to open the storage unit when her strength and the old man's strength isn't enough to do it.
Yeah.
And, you know, the car jack I would think of as a pretty masculine thing. And it's her kind of getting away from this, her feminine side, using this masculine tool to continue to pursue the case. Mm-hmm. And I think something similar is when she's in Belvedere, in that girl's bedroom, and, you know, this is right before she figures out, or right before she goes to Buffalo Bill's house trying to piece this together. She destroys, like, really mangles, which could have been done more delicately, this music box.
Mm-hmm.
And even for a music box, like an extremely feminine, you know, ballerina music box, like pink dancing ballerina. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of the destruction of something so childish and so feminine that allows her to pursue the case.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And
but my question is, like, is this movie saying she has to reject all those things?
I think it is. A little bit. I don't think it's it's making a strong stance on it. I just sort of think it really wants to make sure we know that they're not doing these things isn't necessary. It doesn't you don't have to smash all of these things, you know. But Clarice specifically just wants to prove more or less that she can do it without these typically feminine things. And you know, that seems like a music box that Clarice could have had. A lot of the, like, as a child, I mean, a lot of the girls that are kidnapped by Buffalo Bill have these things that we're supposed to to see as parallels to Clarice. Catherine specifically, like, there's a lot of Clarice just sort of feels like she's saving herself when she's saving Catherine. It's important.
What makes you say that?
There's just sort of the tie-ins to her, Catherine, just sort of being this normal American girl. That's why she's listening to American Girl by Tom Petty. Mm-hmm. It's this very it's a song that can really be read to be about either of them, because part of that is just because the lyrics are so generic, like it, but it also sort of definitely leads someone to think about somebody feeling trapped and trying to get out of something. I think the most popular reading of American Girl involves suicide, but you can certainly go another way. And I think that's sort of the tie-in, is that they're both sort of trapped in something, Catherine much more literally, and Clarice wants to get Catherine out of this trap and wants to get herself out of this trap that has been built for her, of being unable to be an FBI agent as a woman, you know?
Yeah.
And one quick more thing, and then I swear I'll never mention the song American Girl again on this podcast. Something that really made me love Jonathan Demme even more was when she's singing along in the car and she does the Make It Last All Night, like, background vocal. Like, she cuts away from the lead to sing the back. That's something only a director that really loves music would instruct somebody to do, because that's something you would only do if you were singing along to a song for the 25th time. And I got a big kick out of that. And going back to Frederica, yeah, the music box, like, Clarice just sort of wants to, again, destroy her past. And I think that this feminine thing is such a sort of a relic of the past, or could be seen as a relic of the past, because it just sort of represents childhood. She smashes through it, and what does she find? She finds these pictures of very adult situations, exactly. You know? And so it's just sort of moving past her past. And immediately after that sequence, she calls Crawford, who's on the plane flying to wherever they are. Culver City? No, is that right? That can't be right. Wherever they go.
Calumet City?
Calumet, yeah. Somewhere in Illinois. And as she's on the phone, she is framed next to a sort of like a frame with four different pictures of Frederica in them. And Crawford gives her approval, saying, "We couldn't have done this without you, Clarice." And when you look at those four pictures, they are pictures of Frederica as a baby, toddler, about 10 years old, teenage, like graduating from high school. And then right next to them is Clarice standing as an adult. And the framing of that shot is amazing. and so, so great. And I think that's sort of what that scene specifically is meant to say. I don't think she has to reject these female things entirely, but she definitely has to get away from things that are like the past. And
it's not so much the femininity, it's about the girlhood, about the childhood.
Yeah, exactly. She needs to be able to move forward, and this sort of this glass ceiling is stopping her, you know.
Yes.
90s.
Climb that rope ladder through the glass ceiling.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Some more themes I want to talk about in this movie. I just think there's so much in here.
This movie's so dense. It's crazy.
Yeah, there's tons of stuff just packed in. But we talked about power dynamics a little bit, but I still think there's a bunch there. There's a strong theme of collecting in this movie as well. Mm-hmm. And obviously Buffalo Bill, I think, becomes the clearest example, as he, you know, is literally finding new people, keeping them in his dungeon until he can take their skin and then repeat the process, and kind of saving all the skin bodies and stuff and collecting. And that seems to be the most obvious one, but there's a lot of other kind of collecting and categorizing going on in this movie. And I think there's a lot of that in just kind of the psychological field. I mean, it's to study people.
Yeah.
To study anything, let alone people, you kind of start separating what's similar and what's dissimilar. And so you start to categorize things. And, you know, Hannibal's a psychologist, psychoanalyst, whatever the proper term is. and, you know, he sees a bit of that, and he's certainly capable of it, but he's really hostile to it at the same time. Like, the idea of him being captured and him being studied and him being categorized, he really, really doesn't take well to at all. So Chilton always talks about Lecter as an object. Like, he always refers to it as it, or, mm-hmm. you know, my most prized asset. And at the same time, we have Buffalo Bill talking about all his women as it. And it's just weird. Like, Hannibal's kind of kept in this stony dungeon. Bill keeps his victims in kind of a similar thing. And there's these weird parallels between Buffalo Bill and Chilton, and both of them treating people like objects, and taking this power relationship where they're on the top of it and really, really abusing it, mm-hmm. in, you know, different degrees and in different ways, definitely. But, you know, we see Chilton as a villain in this movie, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Like, he works for the FBI, but we're never on his side.
Yeah. He, Hannibal Lecter's the crazy one, but he's still more likable than Dr. Chilton. Dr. Chilton is the asshole who's never done anything totally illegal, you know?
Yeah.
He's able to stay within the what we consider the realm of human decency, but he's a shittier, he's got sort of a shittier view on being polite, I suppose.
Yeah, know? Absolutely.
Or humanistic.
Yeah, and I just think he looks at these psych patients of his as things to be like kept and studied and like shown off and categorized and overall just to be owned. And it's funny how Hannibal is just so so against this. Even to the point where, you know, he has a personal grudge with it, but he kind of refuses to be categorized. Like they say, we don't have a name for what he is. He's a monster. Like he's so out there that he defies categorization. Like you can't properly label what he is. Mm-hmm. And I think that point's driven home really well and really hilariously and simultaneously jarringly when she tries to give him the questionnaire and ask him questions. And he talks about the last census taker who he met, who, yeah. you know, I killed and ate the fava beans, all that stuff. It's just so funny to me that there's all this stuff about categorizing and collecting. Like we have the guys with the bugs. We have all these people in behavioral psychology at the FBI who are just so into labeling people and trying to figure out what they are to these predetermined categories. And mm-hmm. Hannibal just like totally transcends that. And there's just... when asked directly what he is, we either don't have a name for what he is or he's a monster, which means basically he's awful, but we don't understand him. Like we can't give you any more insight. We know he's probably evil, but we can't, like that's as deep as we can go. We can only judge his actions. We still haven't figured out a way to properly judge him.
Yeah, absolutely.
And one more point where they hit it right on the head is, in their first meeting, Clarice says most serial killers keep something of their victim, and Hannibal says, "Not me."
Yeah,
and you know he kind of in that moment accepts that he is a serial killer, but also says, "There's so much more to me. Like, sure, yeah. I have killed people, but I don't just fit your psych profile back at Quantico. Like,
yeah, exactly. There's
more to me."
I'm not like all those other serial killers. I'm a cool serial killer.
I'll let
you drink as long as it's in the house. Yeah.
I don't know if that's what he's going for.
Yeah, I know. I'm fucking with you.
Like, I'll kill people if they throw a semen at you. But
No,
but it's
I'll let you be in a two shot with me if they throw a semen at you.
It's like we're in this movie. Between Migs and Buffalo Bill, we see murderers, we see serial killers, we see all these diagnosed psychopaths, but even Hannibal is so twisted, it's even beyond that. And when he talks about Buffalo Bill as thinking he's a transvestite, but not really being, just realizing he hates himself, mm-hmm. it's or something similar to that. I'm paraphrasing, but that's the gist. Mm-hmm. That speaks to your point about, one, how we see ourselves versus how other people see us. Buffalo Bill has this certainty about who he is and what's going to make him happy. And he thinks he's really a woman, and that once he covers himself with female skin, he'll finally really get to be who he knows he is inside.
Yeah.
And that's Buffalo Bill hiding, essentially. Like, what he keeps from his victims is his skin, and he wants to make an outfit out of it and then hide inside of that as he mm-hmm. doesn't want to look at or know his real self, or thinks he does but fails.
Well, yeah, and that's sort of the importance of his scene where he sets up the camera and does his dance and puts on his makeup and everything, is that he can't – like he's trying to see himself as his ideal self, so he's recording himself – looking how he wants to look so that he can watch it back and see himself how he wants to be seen, you know?
Yeah, and his eyes actually finally meet the camera for the first time, like for an extended period of time when he talks about, you know, how he'd fuck me and how this is who he really is and stuff like that. But what I mean is other serial killers keep something. Our serial killer we have the most contact with in this movie is Buffalo Bill, and he hides something, whereas Hannibal Lecter eats people. He doesn't keep something on the outside. He internalizes it so only he remains. Mm-hmm. And it's like he's just this monster that devours things, and it's still just him. And you don't have now the serial killer and bits of evidence. You just have this serial killer and that's it. Like, it's, we're still at square one. We still don't know anything about this guy. He's racking up the victims, but he's internalizing them, and he's so confident about who he is, he doesn't need to change anything external about him at all. He can just internalize these victims and remain the exact same person he is, and that person is just entirely unknowable. And he's just this, like, beyond Frankenstein. He's just this thing that's misunderstood and powerful, but ultimately out of control and just capable of destroying things around him.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, he's just he's just such a good character, and that's why he got Best Actor after being on screen for, like, you know, 11 minutes, and why I still think
they say I think the count is 24.
Okay, but not a lot for the lead actor. That's true.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, William Hurt won an Oscar for like 8 minutes of Kiss of the Spider Woman or whatever. Oh, yeah. About 5 years before it. Well, but I think it was a supporting actor role.
Okay. Well, yeah, and he only has, I think, 4 conversations with Clarice, and those just stick out because they're so well done and they're so powerful. But it's not a massive role, but it's just a very affecting one that's just done so well.
Yeah, and he's very important to giving Clarice a sort of sounding board for – he never feels like it's weird that she's in the FBI. And I think that's sort of a very important moment for Clarice and her relationship to Lecter and why she's willing to tell him things is that despite the fact that he objects to Crawford sending a trainee at the beginning, he very quickly sort of understands that Clarice is worth talking to, and he doesn't really care if he's male or if she's male or female, just as long as she's interesting, which she is.
Yeah.
And I think that's sort of that's basically all Clarice wants. And so yeah, that sort of really accelerates their intimacy, for lack of a better word, and allows her to give up all of these secrets about herself, and or what I presume to be secrets. Judging by the type of person Clarice is, she doesn't strike me as the type of person that goes deep in personal conversations. And I really feel like she tells Hannibal more than she would tell her closest friends. And I think that's the thing that sort of accelerates that. And another thing I really like about Clarice, you know?
Yeah, and he's the only one that there's nothing, like, one of the few males she speaks to with, I'd say her and Jack Crawford are the only ones I don't get a sexual relationship vibe from at all.
Yeah.
Not that she seems interested in a lot of the men, but they all seem very interested in her physically. And then Hannibal avoids that and actually gets to know her so much better than anybody else in this movie does. And
even the
things we don't see, I agree with you. I don't think she's telling the story of the lambs to maybe not anybody. Like, that wouldn't surprise me at all.
Yeah. And you mentioned Crawford and Hannibal. They are both set up kind of as paternal figures for Clarice in different sorts of ways. Crawford's are more obvious, you know. We've talked about moments of approval that Crawford gives her and how much that means to Clarice. And Hannibal is just sort of, again, somebody that she's willing to tell anything to, you know. She might not tell her closest friends these things, but maybe she would have told her father these things, you know. And maybe that's the void that her father's death left with her. And there are three insert shots in the movie that are close-ups not of faces.
Yeah.
There are some, you know, close-ups of human moments, but because there are insert shots of important objects, like the moth being pulled out of the throat, the mace and the pen in the lead up for Hannibal's awesome escape that we haven't even touched on at all. Because that's boring. That's just a cool action scene. And in this movie, there's too much other bonker shit to talk about. But there are these three really important insert shots in the movie. The first one happens in the first meeting with Clarice and Hannibal. We see a close up of the questionnaire that Clarice has given to Hannibal, and it's like he cares about it, and it's sort of their first moment of any sort of real contact, because it's the first thing she's passed to him, and there's a close up because it's important. Later, as Clarice is being thrown out of the courtroom in Memphis, we get that close up of Hannibal kind of touching her hand as she's getting the dossier from him, back from him. And it's this really just light finger touch of her hand, but it's the only contact that they get. And it's meant to be shown as this meaningful moment. And then the last close up we get of human contact is her handshake with Crawford at the end of the film. And what these three shots show is a progressing, her getting closer and closer to acceptance from these paternal figures and these people that she wants to be seen as equals of. And that's what Lecter's doing by giving her that little touch by his finger, and with the dossier pass. And that's exactly what Crawford's doing at the end. It's like, we couldn't have done this without you, Clarice. And we are equals. Like, I see you as somebody that is an equal with me. And that's something she really wants.
Right. And when he shakes her hand, he says, your father would have been proud today. And the handshake itself, it seems like a hug shake. Do you notice this at all?
Oh yeah, absolutely. There's no real shake. It's more just they just sort of put their hands together and squeeze a little bit. You know, it really is. Your description's very correct.
Yeah, it seems like more like a father just hugging a child. Like, it's not a mutual embrace. It's like, like, as much as I agree, it is about them being equals. It's kind of like that step up, like, this is now or even though, like, he's definitely dominant, still being, you know, where he is in the FBI. This is just like the first time that she gets that. And so it's still not even, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But it's like, this is how you become even, as you do things like this. And I respect what you've done now. And it's just kind of she's, you know, as we said, she's been looking to avenge her father's death by becoming part of the FBI and doing good work there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Crawford is the,
yeah.
Like, as far as we know, like, we don't see a lot of his, we don't see his bosses, we don't see his equals.
He is the part of the FBI Clarice wants to be a part of.
You know? Exactly.
So it's the FBI to her.
Exactly. And so for him to say, you know, your father would have been proud, or that I'm proud, whatever. That's pretty much as good as it's going to get for her. And then we have the phone call from Hannibal.
I love it so much. I love the ending of this movie. And we haven't really mentioned Jonathan Demme's name a lot. But he is a well-liked filmmaker by filmmakers, even though he has admittedly had a pretty spotty career. But Paul Thomas Anderson, huge fan. Huge fan of Jonathan Demme. He has called him his favorite filmmaker, but I take that with a grain of salt. I think it's Altman and then Demme. This movie, the reason I think I love this movie so much is it reminded me so much of The Master, which is a movie I love. I think about pretty much every day in some capacity, and has really stuck with me because it sort of takes this big look at small things, like who is in control is basically the question of The Master. And then they go deep on that question. And this movie is about how somebody sees themselves and how they want to be seen, and achieving that goal by going through the obstacles in between those two things. And Clarice, at the end of the movie, she gets her handshake from Crawford. She's seen how she wants to be seen. Yeah, exactly. She's seen exactly how she wants to be seen. She's got her medal, and just when she thinks she's got everything all figured out, you know, she's escaped from the darkness that has haunted you, Lecter calls and gives her a reminder that there's always evil lurking behind you. And then he goes and stands directly behind somebody, literally lurks behind somebody, and follows them down a street. And it's just sort of this existential ending that you think you get out of what's been bothering you your whole life, and you realize there's always going to be something there. There's always going to be something that you're fighting against, something that really bothers you, because that's just the way it is. And that's why this movie's amazing. It's about all of these incredible things, and then they have the wonderful kindness in them to set up this perfect button of existentialism that I love.
Yeah, well, in my scene with that, it still speaks to so my take on that scene is that it still speaks to the Jack Crawford paternal figure character we were talking about a bit. I think it just coincides with your reading of it there, where she gets this call and it's clear it's you know, it's obviously Hannibal Lecter. She's, you know, very concerned, obviously, or at least wants to do something about this. And then she looks back towards where Jack is just leaving the, we'll call it a party. I bet they have a
Yeah, exactly. We don't know the term that FBI uses for party.
Exactly.
It's classified.
And so we have Jack walking up the stairs, like kind of one shot, and then we cut back to Clarice on the phone. And then she looks around the corner, like looking back kind of into her past, it seems, and looks to the left, which in cinema language is backwards. Like, especially Western cinema, the way that we read left to right, if something, you know, and there's examples otherwise, but usually if things go off to the right, that's forward, future, progress. When you look to the left, you're looking back, you know, regression, things like that. And so we have her look to the, like, come back around the corner of a place that she's already been, like literally backtracking where she is, looking to her, let's say, dad. And just at that moment, two people walk by, and then by the time they're gone, he's out of the room, which is a really cool shot of blocking too. But like, she kind of retraces her step, kind of regresses a bit, looks to her dad for help, and he's not there. And I think it's just them saying, no, you really have to do this on your own now. Like, Jack Crawford's going to be around. You're part of the FBI. Like, you've made it to their level. We think of you as very talented and very good at what you do, but we think of that of you because your independent abilities. And when something goes bad or the scary guy gets on the phone with you, you can't just look back to kind of what your comfort zone is, or these paternal figures, or these people above you who have got you to this place. You have to realize you got yourself to this place, and now it's up to you to get out. And
yeah, exactly. You've gotten yourself to where now, you know, your colleagues are, and they know just as much as you do. You know, like, you are in the same spot, and so you have to deal with the same issues that they do.
Yeah, and I think it's just kind of this brief little moment where she's made it, and then the first sign of something going bad, she kind of regresses a little bit and she's unsure, and then she sees she's on her own. And then we get this shot, and it's this really long shot where he follows Chilton away, and then we just roll credits over more footage. Like, it's and as you said, like, it's always going. And the way that the girls, the female victims in this movie, and the way that Clarice have kind of been the object of gazes, you know, the way Buffalo Bill covets, the way that every male who runs into Clarice feels the need to check her out and ask her out, then we just get left with this gaze, and that's going away. We have the credits rolling over. All our main characters, everyone we know about in that frame, is now out of the frame, and we're just looking at strangers. We know things are happening elsewhere, but that's always what it is. It's never over, and it always continues, and that gaze is always strong, and Clarice is now on her own and has to fight all these things off herself.
Exactly. And I think with that, it's time to leave you to fight your own battles. There's plenty more to discuss in this movie, but we've talked about the big parts, and maybe we'll write a 4,000-page analysis of this movie, because it is got a lot of depth to it. But thank you for listening to The MacGuffin Man. Be sure to check back next week, and also follow us on Twitter at The MacGuffin. Thanks again.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.